The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome to NOAA Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you, the listener, on your legal rights and resources available. Our goal, to empower and put you in charge of your case. I'm your host, Attorney NOAA Davis, broadcasting live from the studios of KLAY 1180 in Tacoma, Lakewood, Washington. Be sure to check out our website at www.noaayourrights.com as we post the audio for each show as well as follow-up information on each program. You can also email me at noaa@noaayourrights.com, and you can visit clay1180.com for more information on this show and additional programming on your conversation station. This is episode 31 of NOAA Your Rights, Bankruptcy. What is bankruptcy? In a nutshell, it's a process under federal statutes and federal rules to, and depending on who initiates and who benefits, to provide protection to persons and companies under financial distress. It means consolidating debt in some cases. It means making reduced lump sum payments. And in other cases, it means winding up and distributing certain assets or returning assets to secured creditors. And in both cases, it means erasing some debt and getting a fresh start. Historically, you may have heard of debtor's prisons, which is true. I mean, that's not a fiction. They did exist, particularly in Europe, but even in the U.S. up until around the 1850s. If a person was unable to pay their debts when due, they were brought to court and imprisoned in a special setting or jail where other debtors were, where they were required to work off their debt or else someone would come to rescue them and pay off their debt. There's actually a famous case in the U.S. Involving one of the signers, the original signers of the Declaration of Independence. His name was James Wilson. He was imprisoned for his debt while he also served as an associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. True story. There was a widespread panic in the late 1700s, and that led to financial distress. James Wilson got in trouble, lost a lot of money, was imprisoned for, I believe, a year of his time at that time, and then ultimately died a year later while still serving as justice on the Supreme Court of the U.S. So it was an archaic and inhumane process of treating people that had incurred financial hardship, treating them like criminals. This is particularly true since most people that end up on the wrong side, and you know this, that people that end up on the wrong side of owing money never intended not to pay. Of course, there are situations of fraud that precede bankruptcy filings. And one of the biggest ones that we all remember, it wasn't that long in the past, was the case of Enron and the massive fraud that they portrayed on the people, their shareholders, the citizens of this country. But there are provisions under the federal law to address situations where bankruptcy is used as a tool to perpetuate a fraud, you know, like running up your credit card within a few days or a few weeks or a few months before you file bankruptcy because you know that you're going to file. There are protections in the bankruptcy code that don't allow people to get away with that. But by and large, bankruptcy is used by good and honest people needing help, needing a second chance. That's what it's there for. In fact, when you look at the number one causes or the substantial reasons behind why people file bankruptcy, what you find is, as number one, it's unexpected, uninsured medical bills. Yeah, medical bills. I mean, you don't expect to have a life-threatening injury or some substantial injury, and maybe you're not covered for it, or maybe the insurance didn't pay for all of it, or maybe there's a high deductible, or whatever the case is. Medical bills tend to be the number one precursor to bankruptcy filings in the U.S. Historically, that's been the case. And I know from being on the district court calendar in our state here in Washington, on many a day I've sat there in the courtroom waiting for my case to be called, and I hear the calendar ahead of me being called, and one after another, it's these plaintiffs' lawyers that work for the collection agencies collecting debt on behalf of hospitals and medical clinics. They're very aggressive in turning those accounts over to the collection agencies, and they get judgments against people just like you, and they get them all the time. We're talking about dozens a day, maybe hundreds a day, and thousands upon thousands during a calendar year all over the state of medical judgments, 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000, 15,000, 25,000, all sorts of different sums, judgments are being taken out against folks for not paying medical bills. So some people that I talk to, they don't want to consider filing bankruptcy, even when faced with a judgment, even when faced with a garnishment and these collection efforts. And sometimes, and for those of you listening that have been in this situation, you know that sometimes those collection agencies can be pretty aggressive and calling at all sorts of days, all sorts of times during the day that you don't want to answer your phone ever unless you know who's calling. Well, why not consider filing bankruptcy? Some people growing up, they see a stigma or they associate a stigma with it. Or if they borrow the money, they feel morally, no matter who they borrow the money for from, whether it's a family member or it's a bank, some bank in a distant state with a high interest rate, those people still, some of these folks I talk to, still feel inclined, morally inclined to pay that money back no matter what. Well, from 1980 to about June 2007, bankruptcy filings in the U.S. had increased nearly every year. So year over year, there's an increase in filings from 300,000 bankruptcy filings in 1980 to about 2.1 million for a 12-month span from 2006 to 2007. So there's a lot of people that are filing bankruptcy despite the stigma that's out there. However, there's a Bankruptcy Reform Act that was passed in 2005, and you might have heard of this. It's called the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act. It's really the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention Act, I think. I don't know about the Consumer Protection Act. That's probably got thrown in there to make it sound good for us, but it was intended to stem the increase in bankruptcy filings because, as I said, they were increasing. I mean, they were skyrocketing, and those lending money, the big banks, the goal was to make it harder for people to qualify for Chapter 7 to do a complete discharge of the monies that they owed. Instead, they wanted to funnel those individuals into a repayment program under Chapter 13. So on October 17, 2005, that's the day the law was passed, you could see that there was an increase in Chapter 13 filings over Chapter 7, but it didn't have the immediate impact of stemming overall bankruptcy filings. However, by 2017, September, bankruptcy filings for the prior 12 months had fallen to 791,000. So you're talking about a high of 2.1 million just about a decade before, down to about 800,000 by September of 2017. So I guess on one hand, you could give some props to the Reform Act for doing what it intended, but you can't give all the credit to the act because the economy plays perhaps an even larger role than do any of the bankruptcy amendments. Maybe another point is helps support that proposition is that most of the consumers, or many of the majority of the consumers that are filing bankruptcy, because the vast number of bankruptcy filings, it's something like 98% of bankruptcy filings are consumer debt, not business related debt, but consumer related filings. Most of the consumer filings are occurring in the South, believe it or not, the Southern states. And those are often seen as some of the poorer states. So they have some of the highest number of per capita bankruptcy filings. For example, one in every 112 people, households, not people, households in Alabama have filed a bankruptcy. That's followed by Tennessee, Georgia, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Those are the states that have the most per family, per household bankruptcy filings in the nation. So if you follow the federal filings, I think you're going to follow the states that have the most impoverished conditions or the lower economic opportunities available. So that's probably what dictates, and we're going to learn more about that in a second, but probably what dictates or predates the filing is economic circumstances, not just of the family or the household, but prospects around you, and that means the economy. So while the percentage of Chapter 13s continue to grow, and that was what that Reform Act intended to do, it wanted to put everybody into repayment as opposed to complete discharge, still even today, 68% of bankruptcy filings are still Chapter 7. So Chapter 13s are continuing to grow, you know, maybe up to as much as 31% of all filings, but 68% of those are still the Chapter 7. Still, the Reform Act did make some notable changes, and maybe we're going to address some of those coming up just after the break, because joining me on Know Your Rights is attorney Randy Martino from the law firm of Lombino Martino. So stay with us. You're listening to Know Your Rights.
When the day turns into night, my hash browns turn into my Jack-in-the-Box $3 munchie mashups. Hash browns and tasty white cheese, mashed up with your choice of savory egg and bacon, buffalo chicken and ranch, or jalapenos and bacon, each for just $3. Because everything gets more interesting at night. Vampires wake up.
Oh, 9 p.m. already.
Mummies unwind.
Hot tub nice.
And the boogeyman gets his boogie on. So come try my late night munchie mashups, back for a limited time, each for just $3. Only at Jack in the Box at participating restaurants.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there, see how we can help you, and if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Hey, parents, do kids think you're out of touch because of the way you dress?
Yes.
Well, say hello to instant style with Fashion On. Just spray Fashion On whatever you're wearing and look cool in an instant. Turn orthopedic shoes into vintage high tops, pleated khakis into skinny jeans. Even clip-on ties become fly gold chains. Just spray, let it dry, and presto.
What about my fanny pack?
You mean your hip MP3 player?
Wow.
What about my bifocals?
You mean your hot pink shutter shades?
Hey, I can't see!
But your kids can see you, and trust me, they see fashion!
Thanks, Fashion On!
Fashion On is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Noah Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping educate you on your legal rights and resources available. We're talking bankruptcy today. We're talking bankruptcy 101. This is one of the topics that I get emailed about consistently by the audience, by the listeners, and those that visit our website. So you want more information on foreclosures. You want more information on what your rights are with respect to creditors. And today we are going to address some of those questions, and we are going to get you some of that information that you need. Joining me on Know Your Rights today to talk bankruptcy with us is attorney Randy Martino from the law firm Lombino Martino. Randy, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
It's a little bit of a tongue twister for me, the Lombino Martino. Oh, I love the name, and we were talking off air. I mean, I don't mean to denigrate the law firm in any manner, but it could be the greatest Italian restaurant in the whole world, Lombino Martino, right? But Randy, if you could tell us a little bit about your background, and you're a named partner in this firm. If you could tell us a little bit about what the areas of practice and what your firm does, that'd be great.
Sure. Lombino Martino, which could also be a fantastic restaurant, maybe a branch off from the law firm, is a law firm that was created and tailored towards the number one client, Legal Shield, and the many tens of thousands of members of Legal Shield in the state of Washington that our law firm services. So we have put together a firm that is very specifically tailored to their needs and the hundreds of calls we get every day on a whole variety of questions. So my particular background is general law and then estate planning for many years. And then when the recession hit and the need for bankruptcies just grew through the roof, we had to open up a department and started meeting those needs, and I've been doing bankruptcy ever since.
Wow. So you, your background, a little bit of a jack of all trades then, a little general practitioner like myself, which I hear that we're a little bit of a dying breed, but you know what? It's perfect in the context of your law firm and Legal Shield, because Legal Shield members don't fit necessarily into one particular practice area. They have a need for a broad array of services, because that's what normal people have, everyday people. We all have a need for a broad array of services. So that's great that you have that background and that your firm offers that. Maybe if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what Legal Shield does and what that connection then is, like how that plays out or how that works.
Absolutely. Legal Shield is a company based in Ada, Oklahoma, that provides legal plans throughout all of North America, every state in the country and most of the provinces in Canada. And there's a provider law firm like our own in every state that is meeting the needs of those members, where members will call in on any number of legal issues. And we, through software and arrangements within the policies and procedures within the office, route those calls to the most knowledgeable attorney to be able to answer those questions. And one of the things that I enjoy the most about the Legal Shield plan is what we call the consultation benefits. There's a variety of benefits under their legal plan, but the ability to call in is, to me, one of the most valuable. Having access to a lawyer that before you would never justify the cost of either a small dollar amount or I don't even know where to start, and I'm not going to go pay money to a traditional attorney just to go figure this out. So the ability to call in, brainstorm, figure out what's going on at no extra cost to you other than your monthly membership, that's pretty awesome. It also includes estate planning benefits, you're getting your wills done and things like that, annual review of those documents, traffic benefits. There's an awful lot of use of traffic benefits. Everybody makes a mistake sometime, and when it's defensible, we're covering those matters throughout the state. And
And I also, one of the benefits might be to review a contract or to write a letter. It seems like that's an important benefit that people want to use too.
As part of that consultation benefit, we're, you know, looking at a contract, reviewing it, especially if it's applicable here. What are the rights, explaining that to the member? And then also to write a letter or make a phone call if that would be helpful. And it's unbelievable how often that has resulted in a positive result, even when in the case of debts. I don't dispute that I owe my credit card, but what can we do? Well, guess what? There's bankruptcy settlement type options that are possible. You're not saying you don't own it. You're just providing access to the legal system and what lawyers do all the time, settling cases and doing compromises and working out a benefit to the member, even when the law was not on your side.
So folks that sign up for Legal Shield end up getting this, they sign up for this access plan. Legal Shield then, if they're in the state of Washington, they route these folks to your firm, which is located here in Pierce County in Tacoma and the Lakewood area. And then whatever their question, concern, issue is, you guys attempt to handle those in-house, and you end up representing people, if you have to, all throughout the state of Washington, right?
Right. So under those consultation benefits, the two main benefits relating to the consultation benefits, and we provide those you know, letter writing, document review, things like that. That solves a bunch of cases. But let's say it goes beyond. You actually have to go sue somebody. You need additional documents drafted that aren't included in the document. Then at least that's going to be referred either in-house or to a referral attorney within our network at a 25% discount. So either way, it seems like a win. You otherwise would have paid for traditional fees for everything, and this allows a lot of routine questions to get handled at no extra cost, and then some of those extras that require local representation or drafting or things like that at a discount.
And it sure helps, like you said, to have access to a lawyer, because sometimes one of the big parts of the problem is not knowing a lawyer who can handle these sorts of things, not having a relationship, kind of being afraid to make that take that leap and make a call, like out of the blue, a cold call to a law firm or to a lawyer saying, hey, can you help me with this issue? So I'm all in favor of prepaid legal plans. It seems like Legal Shield is a great provider of these plans, and we've got a local firm right here. And Randy, I appreciate you joining us today. We're going to talk bankruptcy. That, as I mentioned a moment ago, is one of the hot topics that we get on Know Your Rights. When are you going to talk about these financial considerations? When are you going to talk about foreclosures? Because the economy, my own financial situation is such that I need some help. I need to know what my options are on the bankruptcy front. So what about in your practice from Legal Shield members? Is that something that, and I think the answer to this is yes, because you mentioned this a moment ago, but is that a hot topic among members that you have from Legal Shield too?
Debt impacts so many different areas of law. By itself, as a category of just bankruptcy questions, I think I need to file bankruptcy, what are my options, things like that, that might be in the top 10. But when you start counting all the debt-related issues, creditors filing a lawsuit, you know, that's tagged civil litigation. Somebody's garnished my wages, or all this medical type debt, or a lien got filed on my property and now I can't sell it. All of these things related to debt and circle back to bankruptcy. And those questions are in the top five for sure.
What are some of the questions that really pertain to bankruptcy that you tend to see over and over again?
The most common would be issues about getting caught up on the house, saving the house, possible foreclosure, issues like that. The other most common would be just the mountain of debt, and I'm just buried in it, and I've been juggling the finances, and I can't keep up. So the reality that I'm sinking. I'm not going to make this.
Well, what are the different types of bankruptcies that are out there? Like what when people call up and they say, sometimes people are going to call up and they're probably already going to know some of this information. They did some background. But if it's a caller like me, I'm going to call up and say, hey, I'm thinking about bankruptcy. But what are my options with bankruptcy? Are there different chapters? How does that work?
There's a variety of chapters to fit the different situations. There's Chapter 7, which I think is the most common. It's straight liquidation, and we can talk further about that. Chapter 13, which is an individual's reorganization, where it takes 3 to 5 years versus the Chapter 7 that could be done in 3 or 4 months. And then there's some business-related bankruptcies, like Chapter 7 occasionally, and Chapter 11, which is a reorganization. And occasionally there's a Chapter 12 for farmers and fishermen that I know nothing about, but maybe they do in Eastern Washington. And also even a Chapter 15 for international related stuff.
The predominant number of filings are under Chapter 7. You mentioned that. And I think according to the stats that I said at the opening of the show, over 60% of new filings are still Chapter 7, but approximately 31% are going to be Chapter 13. Can you tell us a little bit about the qualifications for Chapter 7 versus Chapter 13?
You did a nice history and intro in the beginning about the major changes occurring in 2005, where it became a little bit harder to qualify for Chapter 7, the main criteria being the means test. It's taking a look at the median income for the number of people in the household for this region of the country. And it's kind of piggybacking some IRS standards of what they think reasonable is. But, you know, for example, one person in the household would be $65,000. So if you're below that amount, you're eligible. But if you're above, you're failing the means test, but you're not necessarily forced to go into a Chapter 7. There are ways to qualify on what I call the back end by including certain allowed expenses, secured debt like a mortgage, a car loan. If you've got a lot of tax debt that's non-dischargeable, you know, maybe you're going to qualify and fit in there. And then it's important to keep in mind that Social Security income is not counted. So that's a nice factor for qualifying for Chapter 7. And business, if the majority of your debt is business-related, you get a free pass.
And $65,000 is a lot. That's a higher ceiling than I thought. So it's still going to include a lot of people. And perhaps that's why so many of those new filings still fall under Chapter 7. Because every state's going to have a different income qualification because it's going to be based on that state's economics. But $65,000 is, you know, that's a fair sum that people, there's a lot of people in the state that are not making that type of money. So they come to your office, they say, Chapter 7, that's what we want to do. Does the amount of debt they have still play a role in whether or not they're eligible for the Chapter 7 or Chapter 13?
In Chapter 7, no. But in Chapter 13, which is a reorganization, you know, the intention was that this is going to be for smaller individuals that don't have massive amounts of debt. These aren't real estate investors that have lots of secured debt. So in general, your unsecured debt needs to be for a 13 below $400,000 and $1,000,004 for unsecured debt. So there are requirements there. So what happens to an individual who has more, mostly because they have multiple properties, they have one really high mortgage, even if they have no equity, it might be Chapter 11, like big companies.
One of the requirements for the Reform Act was to do credit counseling. Can you tell us a little bit about what that entails and whether it's helpful or not for folks?
Credit counseling is another one of the additions to 2005 requirements, and you have to do it. I've seen people file the credit counseling before filing, which is a requirement, and then fail to file the second one, never got their discharge. So it is an important step. It's not just a small point. But credit counseling is supposed to give you an overview of your finances, figure out a budget. And for some people, it feels like this is too easy and I already know some of this stuff. But for others, it really did act as an education and say, you know, I never quite really looked at a budget before, and this makes a lot of sense, and I am going to move forward with this. So I think it had an educational benefit.
And when we talk about credit counseling in this context of the bankruptcy filing, we're talking about an approved list from the court, right? I mean, this is not some of those fly-by-the-seat-of-their-pants agencies that are out there that say that they want to consolidate your debt. Contact us. You see some of the commercials and stuff. Contact us. We'll help you get rid of that debt. And what they do is the same thing that you could have did individually, which is to call up your credit card company and say, I owe $10,000, here's $5,000, and then they end up hitting you on your credit report for the next 7 years because you paid less than full value. A lot of those credit companies out there, they offer that sort of consolidation, but it's really not. I mean, they end up trying to negotiate down your debt, and it hits people, and they don't understand that. This is a different kind of credit counseling through the bankruptcy process, isn't it?
Absolutely. Completely different. It's tailored specific to the bankruptcy court requirement. There's no upselling or anything like that. You're going to get a certificate. This is all online only, or maybe a phone call. But yeah, this is not some alternative to bankruptcy. This is just a small necessary step to filing.
And the companies that have been approved for this credit counseling, they do appear on like the court website, don't they?
Absolutely.
So you know that this person's authorized. So you want to make sure that when you contact a lawyer for file bankruptcy, whether it's Randy's office or another office, that you end up doing the credit counseling, but you go to the website or you get help from the lawyer to figure out exactly who's eligible to give you that type of counseling. Because there's a lot of companies out there that want to make money off you, that want to take advantage of you, and that's not the approved list from these courts' website. You're listening to Know Your Rights. We're talking bankruptcy. We'll be right back after this message.
Hey, you wanted to see me?
Jack, legal has some concerns about the new Jack in the Box marketing campaign.
Why? It just says my teriyaki bowls are better than ever, with your choice of steak or chicken, plus veggies and white or brown rice covered in our teriyaki sauce. And then everyone's going to love my bowls.
Right. You can't say that last part.
So I can't talk about my sweet bowls?
No.
Can I say my bowls are meaty?
Absolutely not.
But I already put up the billboard that says enjoy my bowls.
Oh, no.
Try my teriyaki bowls, only at Jack in the Box. Limited time only at participating restaurants.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there. See how we can help you. And if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com. And we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
Some statistics are surprising. Some are unbelievable. And some are simply unacceptable. Right now, nearly 30% of U.S. students aren't finishing high school. Nearly 30%. And that's the average. In many places, it's even higher than that. And fixing it is a responsibility that we all share. This is President Obama, and I urge everyone, not just parents, but friends and neighbors and family members, to take responsibility for encouraging the high school students in your communities, to support them, challenge them, push them a little, and do whatever it takes to help them make it through. Because this is one statistic we simply can't afford to ignore.
You can do your part by going to boostup.org and sending an email, a text message, or even a wake-up call to a student at risk of dropping out. Go to boostup.org and provide the boost that's needed to make it to graduation. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Know Your Rights, the show dedicated to helping you learn about your legal rights and resources available. Be sure to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. You can also email me, noah@noahyourrights.com. I'll be sure to answer your question as best as I can. If it's a topic that keeps coming up, we'll certainly put it on our list of shows and topics to have. But I always do the best I can to try to get you the information that you need in your particular case or cases generally speaking. Today's topic is no exception. It's bankruptcy. It's bankruptcy 101. I know you got a lot of questions. I know there's some of you out there that want to call in. I'm usually just concerned about folks calling in and giving up It's hard to be really confidential, obviously, on the radio, and I'm just worried about giving up some of those confidences. But after you listen to the show, you're going to be able to contact me. You're going to be able to contact my my guest today, Randy. I'm going to have his details on the website and his email, so you'll be able to reach out to him. And you can also learn more about Legal Shield and becoming a plan member if you're interested in going that route, too. You don't have to, but that's something that's available as well, and that might be a great benefit that you want to look into. So, Randy, before the break, we were talking about some of the general questions that you get asked when people call up about bankruptcy. And one of the items that you mentioned is foreclosure. And that's one that we get here on the show, Know Your Rights. It's what do I do when I'm faced with a foreclosure notice? So can you tell us a little bit, tell our listeners a little bit about how does bankruptcy affect those folks getting foreclosure notices, or just how does it affect the idea or notion of foreclosure generally?
Foreclosure is when the lender, who's a secured creditor, meaning they've got the ability to sue you or foreclose on the asset that secures that debt. And oftentimes in Washington, they've got an option for an easier, faster foreclosure process through going outside of the court system. And in exchange, they don't seek a deficiency. So that is the most common way that foreclosures happen in Washington. But there's a sale that you first get a notice.
And for those people that are listening, it's called like extrajudicial process or something. And then you'll see if you want to go out and see one, I often see them Fridays at the Pierce County Superior Court, right on outside the second floor entrance. So it's the south side entrance. You'll see these tents set up with people auctioning off houses, and those, I'm assuming, have been foreclosed by the banks.
That's correct. That is the process, to be in a public setting, and sometimes nobody's sitting there, but you're just, you know, rattling off the names of the property and foreclosing on it. And you could be filing a bankruptcy, you know, in theory, a minute beforehand, ideally maybe a day beforehand, and that sale wouldn't be valid. So there's a lot of people who end up filing bankruptcy due to a foreclosure sale. And then we can explain all the different options as to why. But the normal foreclosure process is you'd get a notice saying you're in default. You got 30 days to cure this thing. Otherwise, the formal process of recording the notice of sale set 90 days later is going to take effect. So you've got a window. But like most people, you tend to delay and procrastinate, and you call at the last minute. There's so many more options when you call ahead of time. But let's just say that you do call at the last minute. You know, you could have worked out some deals with lenders, maybe loan modifications, all these other kinds of options that are possible. But if it's too late, then you've got to file bankruptcy. The automatic stay of bankruptcy kicks in, and that prevents all creditors from taking collection action, including foreclosing on a house, and allows that asset to be administered through the normal bankruptcy rules.
That automatic stay is one of the most powerful things about bankruptcy, and we've employed it in cases that I've represented folks on in the past, and that could be you have a hearing that's taking place the next day, or you're scheduled for trial, and ultimately the person that you're representing realize either there's going to be a judgment forthcoming, or they're spending so much money and they can't do it anymore, and so they go ahead with the option. It's not, people will view it as a nuclear option. It's not a nuclear option. It's an option that's available to you under the laws that can help put a pause on the situation. And with foreclosure, that pause can mean you being able to stay in your house or be homeless. I mean, it's a very powerful pause. So when people do file, let's say that our listeners out there, someone has a foreclosure notice they've received. There's a sale set for 90 days from tomorrow. They're scared they're not going to be able to make up this deficiency, because by this time, I mean, if they're that far in arrears, the bank's going to make them pay a huge sum if they're not able to negotiate some type of payments. It's probably pay off everything that's owed at that point. If they contact a lawyer, they contact your office, they file bankruptcy, that stops the foreclosure. That puts an end to it at temporarily. It puts a stay on it, that automatic stay that you talked about. How much notice do they need to give you, your firm, if they call up and they say, hey, we have a foreclosure sale taking place a few days later? How much notice do they need to provide you and your firm in order to file bankruptcy?
Well, at an extreme, it would be a day. But there's no way I personally want to be handling some kind of mess that is going to be dropped in my lap for tomorrow's the foreclosure sale, but let's say that it's within a week or that's still kind of pressing matters. There's an emergency filing that you could file, but to me, you're all in. And the scary thing is what you don't know. And maybe you wouldn't have filed, or maybe you would have filed 13 versus the 7, or maybe some other circumstance could have come into play. So it's like playing the ace up your sleeve as your final move, whether you're ready for it or not. And then you've got 14 days to get the rest of the documents in order and go through the rest of the process. But there are plenty of emergency filings that occur because there's a sale coming up, and that's you can't file the day after the sale. Yeah, you no longer own the property.
Right. So even if the house sold, if you filed, and even if you didn't give notice to everyone that's selling the house, like you didn't run down to the Pierce County Superior Court house steps and said, stop the sale, even if you didn't do that, if the house sold, they know that it's always subject to the sale. Those sales are always conditional in a way, and it's subject to. One of the things it's subject to is if there's a bankruptcy filing, because even if folks don't have notice of it, it doesn't matter. Once you file, that's notice to the world, right?
And correct.
Notice to every creditor, whether they got an actual notice or not.
Correct.
So, you know, you brought up a good point. One thing that I think everyone needs to realize is that lawyers aren't robots, and it's, you know, we have lives too. And sometimes people sit on emergencies too long. They need to identify when there's a really bad financial situation. It's not embracing it, but it's recognizing it. It's recognizing that you're not able to make these payments, and you might be hiding it from your family. You might be embarrassed, but you need to have a consultation with a lawyer about the situation and do something before it's too late, because you might find a lawyer that's not able to do an emergency filing. You might not be able to find any lawyer that can do that within 5 hours or 6 hours. The way the bankruptcy filings are now, people can file them themselves electronically. Obviously, you want to get a lawyer to do that, but if you had to do it, it's foreseeable that you could do it yourself. But I think the point that you make, Randy, is that people need to recognize their situation and try to have a consultation with a lawyer about this in advance. Those I've seen the bankruptcy petitions, they're long. I mean, they make you list out every single asset that you have, your income in great detail, all your debt, your credit cards. So you have to have a lot of information. It's not something that you could put together in a day, really. I mean, because you have to gather information that backs up, that provides the evidence that then goes on to that petition, because you need to identify all your creditors and your addresses and everything else, right?
Correct. And not only that, the Bankruptcy Court for Western Washington is a fantastic website. It's got all sorts of information for people that are considering either learning more about bankruptcy, what are the different options. Here's all of the forms, you know, at no additional cost. They're fillable PDFs. And it even includes some explanations about emergency filings. And I completely agree, not that you want to go do that, because that's diving in and you're really clueless about certain really important things, like any kind of payments to family members or things you forgot to disclose that looks like you're hiding things and now the trustee really wants to go after you, or some asset that now is going to get sold and you didn't intend that to happen. You know, like the boat or the third car or something like that. And so there's plenty of, and then especially the statutes that you're supposed to then line up with your assets to go protect it. How are you going to figure that one out? That's pretty tricky.
Yeah. And there might be some lawyers that are reluctant to get involved in a case if you've already filed it too. So I think filing it, well, I'm all in favor of people being able to handle their own affairs. I really am. And that's what the show is dedicated to. I think that with bankruptcy, boy, it really pays to have a lawyer do that filing for you, a bankruptcy lawyer that knows exactly what they're doing and that you can consult with them, make sure that you get the forms right, you disclose everything, because it might be hard to find a lawyer to pick up the case that you already filed because they got to review everything. It's like you're messing with their system, you know, that lawyer system. So try to reach out, contact someone like Randy, learn more about the bankruptcy process well in advance, look at your situation and make sure that you get a handle on it, and don't wait until it's too late. Don't wait until it's too late. You're listening to Know Your Rights. We're tackling bankruptcy. Stick around. We got lots more to talk about.
When the day turns into night, my hash browns turn into my Jack in the Box $3 munchie mashups. Hash browns and tasty white cheese, mashed up with your choice of savory egg and bacon, buffalo chicken and ranch, or jalapenos and bacon, each for just $3. Because everything gets more interesting at night. Vampires wake up,
9 p.m. already?
Mommy's unwind.
Hot tub nice.
And the boogeyman gets his boogie on. So come try my late night munchie mashups, back for a limited time, each for just $3. Only at Jack in the Box and participating restaurants.
Hi, I'm Noah from Noah Your Rights, the show that helps educate you on your legal rights and resources available to you. You know, I want to be your lawyer, but more than that, I want to help empower you. I want to help provide you the tools that you need to be successful in your case, whether you hire me or you hire someone else. I want you to check out our website, www.noahyourrights.com. See what resources are there, see how we can help you, and if there's something that's missing, email me at noah@noahyourrights.com, and we'll see what we can do to add the material that you need to be successful in your case.
When is the best time to talk to your family about staying in touch during a disaster? When floodwaters reach your door? When wildfires are engulfing the edge of your neighborhood? Or an earthquake is destroying buildings? When a tornado is tearing through town? Or a hurricane strikes? Or is the best time, perhaps, today? During a disaster, you may not be able to stay in touch with your family or friends as easily as you think. And it's not always as simple as using your cell phone. That's why now is the time to take action. Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Noah Your Rights, a show dedicated to helping educate you on your legal rights and resources available. We're talking bankruptcy law today. We're talking bankruptcy 101. With me is Randy Martino from the firm of Lombino Martino here in the Tacoma Lakewood area. They're associated with Legal Shield, a plan access plan that that folks insureds pay a premium for and can have access to a lawyer. Randy ends up doing a lot of bankruptcy and providing guidance to plan members that are part of the Legal Shield plan. And Randy has been gracious enough to come on our show today to talk about bankruptcy 101. Unfortunately, with the way time limits go, we're not going to have a lot of time to get into the depth that we really want to. We might end up having to have a bankruptcy 102. But in the last segment of our show, Randy, I want to ask some important questions that I think have come up among our listeners and that are going to come up in the bankruptcy context. Before I continue those questions, I want to close the loop on this foreclosure. And the thing that came to mind when we were talking about why someone might want to file bankruptcy when they're getting a foreclosure notice, I was thinking, well, what if they know they can't afford to stay in this house anymore? Like, why would you want to file bankruptcy why not just give it up if you know you're going to lose it anyway?
You know, many times people are in a difficult situation. You just lost your job. You might have been working for the last 20 years, and you didn't ask this to happen. Or medical issue forced you to not be able to have an income stream anymore. You didn't ask for that either. So life happens. And thank goodness, that's why bankruptcy laws are a safety net, to be able to help society overall and people in situations like this. But an unknown aspect of bankruptcy, of how it can help, even in a situation where it's the writing's on the wall. You can't keep this house. The budget doesn't allow for it. Many bankruptcy trustees want to work with the lender to try to sell the house, and that could cause further delays in the process, but it benefits everybody. The lender's eventually going to have to sell it. After they completed the sale, that you're going to have to sell it, so why not just sell it with the bankruptcy trustee who works with a real estate agent who's trying to sell it? And sometimes it'll sell right away, but oftentimes it takes, 3 months, 6 months, I've seen it go over a year. Meanwhile, you're staying in that property, you're not homeless, you're building a transition plan to your new situation. You might get a job during that time, you might get healed up and can work again. There's all sorts of reasons for why that extra delay could be a lifesaver.
So your situation may change. You may be able to make the payments after all, may be able to work something out through the bankruptcy court with the help of the trustee, or worst case scenario, like you said, you get to stay in that home for another 6 months, 7 months, 8 months longer, and you might not even be paying anything that entire time, right? Because if a plan hasn't been worked out, and Chapter 7 you wouldn't pay, but in Chapter 13, you're not necessarily paying into the plan until it's been approved. So I don't know if you're called the debtor in possession or whatever at this point, but you're staying in that home and you're not paying that mortgage on it, right?
Absolutely. That's the worst case scenario, where that still turns out to be a huge lifesaver. But even the people who do have a job and they're just behind on the mortgage, that's where Chapter 13 can help out. But these days, ever since the recession and loan modifications, many lenders are willing to do loan modifications. Right. You just needed a few extra months to start that communication. And sometimes you're talking to the bankruptcy department, no longer the collection department, who's much more agreeable to some kind of workout. So I've seen plenty of happy endings.
Do not,
for that.
If you end up going behind on your mortgage and you get a foreclosure notice, do not let it go into foreclosure. Contact Brandy, contact a bankruptcy lawyer, make sure that you weigh out your options. Definitely do that. If that's the one thing that you learn from any of my shows, please, please remember that one piece, the power of the bankruptcy filing, the automatic stay, and putting a stop to that foreclosure. And maybe, just maybe, it's either going to just buy you, well, we know it's going to buy you time, but maybe, just maybe, it also lets you put your feet back on firm ground and be able to recover something, whether it's staying in that house or selling it at that point, but doing something that betters your position. Randy, I want to talk about, after you file a petition for bankruptcy, Chapter 7 or Chapter 13, what's the process look like at that point?
The process starts first with an interview with the potential client, signing fee agreement, gathering up documents, bank statements, pay stubs. That means test that's part of the bankruptcy now since 2005 requires 6 months worth of pay stubs to try to estimate what your annual income is. So gathering up information about assets, their values, you're using, you know, online values. For your household items, even you're listing things like that as well, just to be thorough. And you're also figuring out your income and your monthly expenses. Then there's statement of financial affairs that has a laundry list of your income for the last 3 years. Lots of paperwork to fill out. But let's say the client has filled out the paperwork, the attorney has looked it over, everything is looking good, we've dealt with any problems that would come up during that time, then you go ahead and file. About 30 days after filing is when the one and only meeting you need to attend in person, and it's called the Meeting of Creditors. It's called the 341 Meeting of Creditors because that's the section under the bankruptcy code. And creditors, ironically, don't show up. It's hardly any creditor would show up because why would I spend more money to have it discharged? And so really it's pretty rare to have a creditor show up. Oftentimes it's just the attorney, the client, and the bankruptcy trustee. And the trustee's job is to make sure everything is disclosed, you're playing by the rules, you didn't forget to list something. Like the common things they remind you are an auto accident. I have 3 years to sue somebody. I didn't think I'd get anything, but you've got to disclose it. Otherwise, this is not your asset to protect later. Or an inheritance. Somebody died. I don't know if I'm going to get anything. Oh, and then after the bankruptcy, somebody told me about it. That's an asset of the bankruptcy. So they'll make sure that everything is disclosed. And then that's when the trustee, shortly after that meeting, and that's usually the only appearance in court, will end up filing a report. Either they're investigating assets, or the vast majority of cases are what we call no asset cases. The trustee files a report and they're done. And then it's really a hurry up and wait situation because about 70 days later is when most people, their bankruptcy case will close. And 60 of those days will be when the order of discharge comes. So the order of discharge comes, and then about a week later, the order comes closing the case. So that's the most common scenario. And let's say that foreclosure scenario, the trustee would say, I'm investigating assets, let's see if I can make a short sale work. And then the case stays open, but to you, it really feels like it's over. Mm-hmm. Technically, you don't want to do any big transactions like selling a car, transferring anything without checking with your attorney. But even that oftentimes turns out to be fine too. It'll feel like it's over.
If a married couple comes to you, you know, we're in Washington State, it's a community property state, do both parties need to file bankruptcy, or can they do them individually, or only one file?
Yeah, it's that's a good question, because in community property states, actually anywhere, the spouse doesn't have to file, but in a community property state, all of the community assets and all of the community debt is included in the bankruptcy. Mm. Now, there could be some trade-offs, because in Washington, it's also favorable that you get two types of exemption schemes, and state exemptions or federal, and that exemption is the dollar amount you're given to protect your assets. Sometimes it's helpful to have a spouse double up the exemptions to protect the assets, but many times that the circumstances are right, where one set of exemptions is enough to protect the assets, you're still disclosing all of the non-filing spouse's assets, debts, their income, and figuring out the monthly budget. But when all of that works out, even with one filing, one can file. Now, technically, the non-filing spouse didn't get a discharge, but they have the benefit of the discharge of the filing spouse, because creditors can't go after community assets, which are your wages and all the assets you disclosed.
Yeah, and so there might be a benefit there depending on whose name the car's under, because not all spouses put the car under both their names, so that might be a reason why one files over the other one. So that comes up, and also the house, sometimes it's under both or one, too. What about in a divorce situation? What impact is a filing going to have on a divorce? Is the automatic stay apply? And does alimony go away? Does child support go away? What are the impacts there?
So it's easiest when these issues come up before you've actually filed divorce. But a divorce is a proceeding that divides debts and assets and is impacted by the automatic stay. So that's how powerful automatic stay is. It stops everything and gives everybody a chance to kind of figure out, am I impacted by this? Am I not? And so many, I understand from family law attorneys that, you know, the proceedings will stop during that time. Now there's pros and cons of, hey, should we file before we get divorced or after getting divorced? There's many divorces where the debts are gonna go after either one. And the creditor is not bound by that divorce decree. They can go after either one. So both will be impacted at some point, but you could do one filing when you're married versus two filings when you're not married anymore. So that could be an advantage right there.
Yeah, people don't understand that. This happens in divorce all the time, that the court will award a debt, if you want to call it award, or they'll end up putting debt on one side. Like, let's say it goes to the husband. Well, if both spouses' names are on that debt, it doesn't mean that Capital One or Wells Fargo, whoever it was, can only look to the other, to that particular spouse. If both spouses signed up for that debt, they're both responsible for it. It doesn't matter that you have a court order saying that one spouse is liable for it. I mean, you could go after that spouse for not paying. One spouse can go after the other spouse for not paying for it, but it doesn't impair the right of the creditor to go after each of the spouses. And so what you're saying, bankruptcy, same situation. It might be discharged with respect to one spouse, but if both spouses are on that credit card, that debt's not discharged in full because the other spouse is still liable for it, right?
Correct. Oftentimes, it's really going to benefit both. And so that's a real positive.
Well, what about, there's so many more questions I want to ask you. I'm going to have to bring you back on, I know it, and because there's a lot more that we want to go into in depth on this, but I want to ask you one final question. That's, how does a bankruptcy ultimately affect your credit?
A bankruptcy will last for 10 years on your credit for Chapter 7, 7 years for Chapter 13. All other debt information falls off after 7 years. But many people have a misconception, like, I'm never going to get credit again. And the reality and irony is that you're going to get inundated with credit card offers during the bankruptcy, of all things. And most people's credit actually improves after a year, whereas if it's been tanked, you know, for year after year after year, it's always going to remain.
Because you can still file bankruptcy in the case that you've of someone that hasn't filed yet. Whereas if you have filed, the credit card companies know that you cannot refile Chapter 7 within a certain period of time anyway. So
absolutely. You just got all your debt wiped clean and you're not filing again for another 8 years. So you're looking good.
All right. Well, this has been a show on Bankruptcy 101. We just really touched the surface of it. We're going to end up having another show, but I hope that you got something out of today's show. I certainly did. I want to thank Randy for joining us. I'll put Randy's details on the site. You've been listening to Know Your Rights, the show that's dedicated to you, the listener, and educating you on your legal rights. We'll see you next week, same time, same day. Be safe out there.